Welcome to MIT Talks. I'm Vita Bilkis.
And I'm Dana Attar. MIT Talks set out to bring you the stories that shape the people of MIT.
And I'm Sarah Trice. As the co-hosts of MIT Talks, we go behind the scenes with some of the most influential members of the MIT community, past and present, to dig deeper into their unique and inspiring journeys.
So tune in, listen, learn, and grow.
This is MIT Talks. Hello, I'm Vita Bilkis, your host for today's episode of MIT Talks. Today's guest, Andrew McAfee, is the co-founder and co-director of MIT's Initiative on the Digital Economy and a principal research scientist at the MIT Sloan School of Management. He studies how digital technologies are changing the world. His most recent book, More from Less, is the surprising story of how we learn to prosper using fewer resources and what happens next. Was published by Scribner in the fall of 2019. His 2014 book, The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies, co-authored with Eric Brynjolfsson, won several awards and has been both a New York Times and Wall Street Journal top 10 bestseller. Another book he wrote with Eric, Machine Platform Crowd, Harnessing Our Digital Future, published in 2017, offers an executive's guide to succeeding during this turbulent era. These books have been translated into more than 15 languages, and Andrew and Eric are the only people named to both the Thinkers 50 list of the world's top management thinkers and the Politico 50 group of people transforming American politics. Andrew was educated at MIT and Harvard and lives in Cambridge. In this episode, we chat about some of the highlights of his career, what were some of his biggest challenges, and he shares with us what he is working on next. I know you will enjoy our chat just as much as I did. Welcome, Andrew, to MIT Talks. We're so excited you agreed to do this with us.
And I'm still not sure why, but here we are.
Here we are. So, Andrew, you and I could probably set aside hours to talk about the volume of work that has made up your life. And, you know, you really have touched topics that shape our lives today and our lives into the future. And it might be really great to set some context for people about some of your work and your experiences, because here at MIT Talks, we want to hear a little bit about the background of your journey. And one of the highlights, you know, of your career, I'm sure, was speaking at TED, at a time where TED was really the forefront of bringing out these wonderful and amazing ideas to the forefront of our minds. So can you share a little bit about what that was like and what brought you to TED?
I gave my TED talk in 2013, which was the last year that it was held in Long Beach, California, before it moved to Vancouver. Eric Brynjolfsson, my co-author on The Second Machine Age and a couple other books, also gave his TED talk that year. And a couple things stand out super clearly in my mind. One was that I was crazy nervous, and I do a fair amount of public speaking, but this was TED. And in the session where I was speaking, you looked out in the front row of the audience, and there's Bill Gates sitting next to Martha Stewart, and it just goes from there. And this is kind of a big chance, and you don't want to screw it up for all kinds of reasons. And the guy that organizes TED is named Chris Anderson, and he's a complete pro. He's just amazing at what he does. And he can read speakers really well. And he saw that before our segment started, all the speakers were off in one little area of it. And I was kind of huddled down into myself, basically sitting up, but in a fetal position, probably rocking back and forth and trying to remember exactly what my talk was and all the transitions and segues. And I was just kind of curling down more and more into myself. And I'm looking straight down and I see a pair of shoes in front of me. And my thought was, I am not in the mood to talk to anybody. Whoever you are, just go away. So I look up and there's Chris Anderson standing in front of me. And he just looked at me and he fixed me with his gaze and he just said, "You are ready to give this talk." And it was amazing because it was exactly what I needed, like that piece of encouragement right then and there. And so I went on stage and the whole thing passed by in a whirlwind. The other main thing that I remember was we were all of the speakers in that segment were backstage getting mic'd up and we're all releasing our nervous energy before we're about to go out. And one of the people in my segment was a teenager, maybe 16 years old, who had helped come up with a new diagnostic test for a kind of cancer. It's kind of an amazing story. A really, really sweet-natured kid. And we're all backstage and we were all saying, you know, what did you do to prepare? Like, what did you do to calm down your nerves? He said, I had a big bowl of ice cream, which I thought was the sweetest thing in the world. And I said, man, when this is done, I'm going to go get a drink. What are you going to do? And he said, I'm going to eat some more ice cream.
That's a great story. So, I mean, that must have been really an incredible experience. And, you know, what do you think it was about Second Machine Age that, you know, became a national bestseller, international bestseller, really spoke to people who were looking ahead to the future for their own organizations, for their own lives? So could you share a little bit about what you think really was so impactful at that time for this message to land?
Oh, yeah, it's really simple. We just got lucky. It landed at exactly the right point in the national conversation, the right time when we were ramping up all of our thinking about these crazy, powerful new technologies and where they might be taking us. And I think you surf a little bit. You don't catch every wave. I think Eric and I just caught a wave with this. Again, I'm not ashamed of the book at all, but one thing you learn is that unless you're kind of, you know, Michael Lewis, Malcolm Gladwell kind of territory, it is not a guarantee that everything you do is going to wind up being an international smash hit and cause everybody to jump to their feet and applaud. I try to understand the role of luck in things, and the role of luck keeps on being larger than I think over time. So we got lucky with Second Machine Age.
Well, I think you're being very modest. Your work is very well
received. I've got a lot to be modest about.
So give us like the one for the listeners who may not have read your book. What was the main gist of Second Machine Age?
Eric and I looked around and we're both kind of obsessed with technology and technological progress, in particular with digital technologies. And the two of us just kind of kept talking. And we realized that we had the same view of what was going on, which was that we are right now living through one of those once-in-a-century periods when there's a surge of technology that comes and it interrupts and it accelerates the normal march of change and progress. You know, we've always got new technologies coming at us. That's great. That's how we improve our lives and our standard of living. But the steam engine was exceptional, even by that standard. The internal combustion engine, electricity, these things were exceptional, and they really did provide a jolt to our economies and our societies. And Eric and I kind of thought we were living through another one of those. Even though the computer had been around a long time, even though the personal computer had been around, by the time we wrote the book, the smartphone was a pretty well-established thing. It just felt like there was enough different kinds of momentum, and this thing needed to be highlighted and talked about in a more specific way than people had been doing it before. And I want to be clear, lots of people had been doing work like this. This is not some magic new idea that occurred to me and Eric. We just wrote it up and got lucky with the timing.
That's great. And that really then, it seems, propelled your and continued then your life's work and your really your career that I don't think you know, no one wakes up as a child and says, I'm going to be a spokesperson and an author and a speaker. And, you know, I mean, did you have any of those ideas as a kid that there could be a career like this, say, a thought leader, you know, really helping us?
And all the labels are terrible, right? Thought leader, futurist, speaker, influencer. All those are just, I don't think of myself as any of those things. So I really don't like it, but it's actually accurate that a bunch of my work has been writing books that hopefully lots of people read instead of just a few people, and then going around and talking about the work a lot. It's weird. I had no idea that it was a career or a way to make a living or a thing that existed in the world until it kind of happened. A little while back, Adam Grant, who's this wonderful human being, professor at Wharton, he and I were interviewing each other for our podcast in the back of a car when we were riding somewhere. And I said, Adam, I want you to tell me what it was like when you realized you were aghast. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, this is a phrase that I came up with. It's a global alleged smart person. And like, that's your job description now. What's it like? And we both agreed that it was just this, it's a deeply weird thing. And you always have to keep the alleged in mind.
So tell me, when you were a little kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I mean, little kid things. It might have been one step more realistic than Lion Tamer, but not a lot. But what I do realize and remember is the, you know, that homebrew computer, that the really early personal computers hit when I was right around 10 to 12. And apparently the things that happen to you at that age are really, really formative. It turns out that for men, at least, the baseball team that was dominant or that you followed when you were 10 years old is actually the one that will follow you around for the rest of your life. And so I think, again, I got lucky because this thing called the personal computer, the computers that were accessible to normal human beings, came out at this age when your brain is kind of looking for something to latch onto. So I remember a couple of very vivid incidents of, oh man, this thing is cool. And I guess if you have inherently nerdy wiring and you come across a computer, you know, there's instant chemistry there.
And so that must have been some of the pathway that got you then to MIT.
I was actually trying to remember when I was thinking about this conversation, how I first heard about MIT. And I actually don't have a clear answer to that question. It might have been from reading Feynman's books, but that seems a little bit late to me. But if you are a nerdy little kid, at some point you hear about this mythical institution in Cambridge, Massachusetts called MIT, where nothing but super geniuses hang out and it must be awesome all the time. And that notion kind of got stuck in my head. And I remember when I was in high school, in classes like physics, I got good scores on tests. But if I missed a question, I would say to myself, people who go to MIT don't miss questions on high school physics tests. Like, what is wrong with you?
Wow.
One of my most vivid memories, I think, of my life was that the day when you get the envelope. I think, I don't know if you still get envelopes, but back then you got a physical envelope. And I opened it up and, you know, the first sentence was, congratulations, we'd like to offer you. And I leaped into the air like I had just pitched the final pitch in the World Series. My brother was with me. He caught me on the way down. We did some super like awkward dance for a while at the doorway of my house because I just felt like I'd been offered like a ticket to the show, like the chance to go play with the grownups. And I remember thinking, this is unbelievable. Like, I never could have expected this.
And so you were an undergrad at MIT and then
I was a master's student. I was in it was then called the Leaders for Manufacturing program, or the LFM program. It's now called the LGO program. But I must have some sadistic tendencies because I did two undergraduate degrees and then I signed up to do dual master's degrees right immediately after that. And I remember that story very vividly because I had just turned 21 and my buddies, of course, said, oh, you've just turned 21. Let's go drinking. And back then, the law in Massachusetts was not as smart as it is now. So the instant you turned 21 at 12:01, they would start serving you. And I was not a big drinker at all, but my friends tried to cure that in one night. And the next day, someone came and knocked on my door and said, hey, there's a phone call for you. This is way back before everybody had a phone. And so I stumbled down the hallway in the state that I would now call a hangover, but I just thought was near death. And somebody said, hey, you know, congratulations. Just want to let you know we've admitted you to the Leaders for Manufacturing program. And I think I croaked out like, that's awesome. Thank you. And I went back to bed because I just felt like death. I literally called the guy back. This was on a Friday. I called him back on Monday. And I said, just want to make sure that I remember this correctly and that this phone call happened and you admitted me into the program. And he's like, yeah, we did. We were kind of wondering what was up with you last Friday. And that was the start of my graduate studies at MIT.
And then I know there's like part of your life you spent a little bit downriver. You know, tell us about that.
When I left Harvard about 12 years ago now, and I left the business school and came back to MIT, came back to Sloan, I think it was actually a really, really bad idea because it was one of those moves that simultaneously lowered the average IQ of both institutions. And I don't think you should be like that. As a rule, that's not a good thing, not a great thing to do. But yeah, I did my doctorate and then I taught at Harvard Business School for about a decade and then came back to the mothership.
And tell us about ID and your work with MIT now.
Eric Brynjolfsson and I and our colleague David Verrill a while back realized that this phrase, the digital economy, this needs to be a phrase. This is where our economy is going, and it needs an academic home. And so the three of us started up the initiative on the digital economy. I think Eric got so disappointed with us, or so mad at New England weather, that last year he took off to Stanford. So he's left. And Sanan Aral, my MIT colleague, is now the director of the IDE. So we've got great continuity. But we just think that, our economy is living through one of these deeply profound transitions. It needs to be studied. And one thing a great institution like MIT can do is conduct research, get the word out, act as a convening site, bring people together, and just kind of get the ideas out there. And that's what we're in the business of doing. The motto of MIT is head and hands. You know, you got to get out there and affect the world.
Fascinating. So, you know, you touched a little bit upon this when you were sharing about your experience at TED and feeling that nervousness that you faced. And I'm sure you've had a little bit of touch of that at different points in your career. For our listeners, do you have any really good strategies for people? Do you still feel that? Is that something that you really had to practice to overcome? Or, you know, any tips here for our listeners?
If I don't feel that, it's a signal that I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing. That I'm just phoning it in. So the butterflies never completely go away, and I don't have great strategies for coping with them, except to realize that most of the rooms that you're going to be in, the people there want you to succeed, not fail. And keeping that in mind is probably pretty good. I am an introvert. I like being on stage because I like sharing ideas, but I don't like a lot of different social situations. So when I get off stage, I'm really happy to go to a room and be by myself for a while. So that recharge time turns out to be really important.
So important. Great takeaways there.
But when I was at Harvard, there was an older colleague of mine. I think he'd been teaching there longer than I had been alive. And his name was Warren McFarlane. He was a legend at the school. Great teacher, great citizen. And I got the chance to teach with him and watch him do speaking and whatnot. And he was insanely popular, and I couldn't figure out why, because I studied him pretty closely. And no matter what audience, he killed. And I kept on waiting for him to stumble or for it not to go well. It never happened. Like the most senior executives, MBA, everybody, alums, he would rolling in the aisles. And I'm like, what is going on? And finally, I realized one of the keys to his success, and I've always tried to keep this in mind. Warren always acted like he was the person that most wanted to be in that room. And when that nickel dropped, I think things got a lot better for me. And that doesn't mean you have to be the liveliest person or crack the biggest jokes. But if you're not communicating, if you're talking and you're not communicating, this is a thing that you really want to be doing, do something else.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's a great lesson for all of us. So, you know, I think it's interesting for us now, as many of us would look up to your accomplishments and imagine an easy street to, you know, you get TED, you get a New York Times bestseller, you know, things just start pouring in, invitations, you know, from top leaders all over, all kinds of organizations. Do you recall a time in your life where you were really challenged and you just thought, you know, wow, how is this going to work out?
Nope. Been one smooth escalator ride up. I didn't get tenure at Harvard, and that was absolutely a crushing blow in my life because I had spent about 15 years there. I had oriented myself toward being a professor at a business school. You start to buy into like that whole environment. You define what success is, and the path is really clear, and it didn't happen. And that was really not one of the highlights of my life. And it was a dark time. Luckily, MIT, and in particular, Eric was there, and he said, well, come on, let's figure this out. And the school was incredibly receptive. But wow, you mean you can get knocked on your butt in many, many, many worse ways than that. Like, I'm not pretending. This is a champagne problem, right? But to me at that time, it was a problem. And I think you carry around your failures with you probably to some extent all the time. So that failure is still part of who I am, and it's still not my favorite thing that's ever happened to me. And, you know, hopefully it makes you humble or a little kinder to people. I was actually, I got invited to the economics conference at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and I wound up having dinner next to Janet Yellen one time, and which was fantastic. It was really wonderful to talk to her, but she brought up at some point over the dinner that she didn't get tenure at Harvard either. I'm like, oh,
we're in the club.
We're good. Yeah, fine.
Well, thanks for sharing that vulnerability with our listeners.
Yeah, thanks for dragging it out of me.
It's kind of like kite surfing, right? You fall, you get back up. Yeah. Your favorite. Tell us about your favorite new hobby.
I like the ocean because I like scuba diving, but I'm not a sailor or anything. But I was walking down a beach in Florida a few years ago, and I saw people out kite surfing, and I thought it was just the most beautiful and magnificent thing because they had these kind of like dandelion puff kites up in the air that were letting them skim over the top of the ocean. I thought that is amazing. I can never, ever learn to do it, but it's this wonderful triumph of some combination of human stupidity and human ingenuity. Because the notion that you should even try that is a real, like, that is a far-fetched notion. And I've watched the documentaries about the birth of the sport, and these guys were crazy. They were out there coming close to killing themselves a lot, but they finally refined it. And the amount of gear and technology and knowledge embedded in the kitesurfing gear that you use today is unbelievable. It's just a triumph of tinkering and innovation and perseverance by people who are deeply passionate about something. So I dig all of that about it. But honestly, I think a big part of it was, I think I do some things to fight against being a conservative, closed off, clamped down, set in his ways, middle-aged dude, even though if that's like probably who I actually am. Once in a while, I feel the need to kick back about that. And so I thought, this is amazing. I really want to see if I can do it. And like doing hard things is probably, or not just keep doing the same thing that you already know how to do and maybe doing a little bit better. Trying something new and difficult feels like a good thing for, you know, some middle-aged dude to keep trying.
So is that why you ended up going to Burning Man? I know you have a big circle of friends in San Fran, and they were always inviting you and you know, were eager to have you come. And it took a few years to convince you to come, but I hear that you're a convert now.
Burning Man is one of those things where everybody has an opinion about it, whether or not they have gone. And I had very strong opinions about it. Most of them were negative, and I'd never gone. And like you say, I've got a bunch of friends out in San Francisco, and they finally said to me, you need to stop shooting your mouth off about this, and you probably need to experience it. And so I like the fact that it's a huge event. The scale of it is kind of crazy. I think about 30% of the world's LEDs are concentrated in the Nevada desert for that 1 week. So the scale is kind of staggering. I like the fact that the values are all about tolerance and inclusion and just kind of, you know, being nice to other people. But fundamentally, it's a big old slog into the desert where you get to go do like deeply stupid things with your friends for a week. And okay, like I probably need a little bit more of that in my life instead of a little bit less.
Keeps you alive.
But yes, I have gone.
I think that just shows, you know, gives our listeners a taste of that. You know, sometimes you have to try new things, as you said, whether it's kite surfing or going to Burning Man to get your imagination sparked.
And I don't know if there are cognitive benefits to it. I like to think that there are, but I honestly don't know the research. There probably aren't. It's a thing that you tell yourself. But again, just like, it's easy to keep doing the same thing, especially if the feedback is good from it. If you think you're okay at it, you know, write one more book, go give one more talk. And I want to go do all those things. But if you're given the great ability to have the option of kicking yourself out of that rut, then you should probably kick yourself out of that rut.
Totally. Well, the other day, I was searching for new books to read, and this is a true story. I was not doing research for our interview here. I was just curious about finding a new book. And I landed on a website that aggregates books that people have recommended, and I saw that Mark Andreessen had called your book, More From Less, one of the best books of 2019. And many others have praised the book, as your research shows that it's through capitalism and innovation that the world has dramatically improved and has used, you know, just like the title says, more from less. I think this narrative is not always the most popular narrative that we hear nowadays. Could you speak to your conviction on this?
Yeah, I wrote More From Less because I read this online essay in 2015 written by a wonderful scholar named Jesse Ausubel, who said, hey, America's using fewer minerals, fewer tons of fertilizer, fewer tons of wood, less paper now year after year. And I said, no, it's not. Like that's not how growth works. Growth is there are more Americans year after year. We have a higher standard of living. Our economy grows. And the inputs to growth, one of the inputs are materials, is stuff. And we can get more productive, but yeah, we're still going to take more from the planet. We live on a big planet. Maybe it's going to be okay. But yeah, we take more from the planet year after year. And Jesse's a wonderful scholar, so he included all of his sources. And I went and looked him up and I started double checking. I'm like, this guy's right. Wait a minute. Because I went back and looked as far back in the historical record as I could. And for just about all the time that we human beings have been around, the only way that we became more populous or more prosperous was by taking more from the earth. You know, the industrial era, we took more coal and more fossil fuels year after year. We dug more mines. We cleared more forests. We planted more crop acreage. Yeah, more, like clockwork. And then at least in the country, the rich countries where we have good data, those trends decoupled and our prosperity continued, but our need for molecules leveled off. And then for most molecules is now going down, not per capita, not per American, but by all Americans put together, even after you take globalization and trade into account. And I think this is a weird phenomenon, a really deep one, a really encouraging one. And so that led to the book More From Less.
That's a great read. I highly recommend it. And can we share with our audience that you are working on a new book? Tell us a little bit about that.
I think I've learned that unless I have a book project to work on, I get antsy about things. So I am trying to write a book now. And there are two ways to explain it. Number one is that I'm trying to tell the world what Silicon Valley is trying to tell the rest of the economy. And what I mean by that is when I spend time out in the Valley, and that's Valley's a metaphorical statement, right? With really super geeky companies doing cool things with technology. And I've also in my career spent a lot of time at companies that I'd call them the industrial era companies. These two kinds of companies are different from each other. They are different. The vibe is profoundly different. It's not just because of the foosball table and the dogs and the snack. That's not it, right? The culture at these tech companies is different. And I want to be really clear. I'm not saying it's perfect. I am not saying that there aren't issues going on in tech. There absolutely are. I want to be really clear. What these tech companies have demonstrated an ability to do is remain agile and innovative and be able to execute and give their employees a sense of agency and empowerment, even as they become really, really big companies. I kind of don't think we've seen that before. And my favorite way to try to communicate this is, you remember the movie Ford versus Ferrari that came out? Like, who's the underdog in that movie? Ford, right? Ford is the underdog. Ford at the time of the movie was the third largest company on the face of the planet. They almost bought Ferrari for what would have been 3 days' profits for that company. And they're the underdog. Mm-hmm. They had the best driver. They had the best car designer. They're the underdog in that movie. And everyone just kind of walks in waiting to, like, the plucky Ford comeback story. Ford was a massive sclerotic bureaucracy already by the 60s. And our intuition now is that's what happens to companies as they grow. They get bogged down. They become bureaucratic. The evidence is really clear about this. Projects start slipping. Culture, like turf wars kick in. And they become kind of like the kinds of companies that we like to make fun of. We like to make fun of the geek companies, but for different reasons. And I've heard them described in all kinds of different ways by people who are not fans of high-tech companies. I have never heard them described as sclerotic, slow-moving, bureaucratic, not in it. It just, you would not use those words. Something's going on there. Something really, really interesting is going on there. And what the broad story, what I think is going on is that the geeks have backed into a better way to get people to work with each other in groups inside a company. And I mean better, I think, in a pretty specific sense, better in the sense that it takes human nature into account in a deeper level. Because over the past decade or so, there's been this wonderful confluence of research in anthropology and psychology and economics and biology that's kind of like looked at and said, okay, like, who are we? Like, actually, what's going on with us? And the answer is that of all the species on the planet, we are in most ways that you or I would think to measure, we're the most intelligent. We're super smart, good for us. And we're ultra social. We cooperate at scale and in ways that are unknown in the rest of the animal kingdom. As somebody summarized it really beautifully, he said, you will never, ever see two chimpanzees carrying a log. Okay, so we're this really smart, really ultra-social species. What does that imply about us? And it implies some really good things. We're driven, we're passionate, we're creative, we are deeply altruistic, because one of the ways that you succeed in the evolutionary battle, if you're a member of a smart, ultra-social species, is by being pro-social, by being one of the good guys. So it kind of resolves that, why are we humans selfish and altruistic at the same time? Because it makes all the sense in the world. That's how we should be. However, we are also, we're super self-interested, we're greedy, we're status-obsessed, we're gossipy, we're vindictive, we're deceptive, we kid ourselves all the time. There are a bunch of adjectives that are not as kind of exalted as creative and intelligent and altruistic are. We need to take those other adjectives into account, or we're going to screw up the way that we design, that we run companies. And what I think is going on is that the geeks, whether or not they've read all of these brand new books in the science of human nature, they're kind of building companies that reflect an understanding of that kind of stuff. So in other words, why do we A/B test everything? Because if I have a great idea for a website change, I'm so convinced it's going to work that I don't even need to test it. And chances are excellent, it's not going to work at all. So, you know, we humans are deeply overconfident, and we have to use the tools of science and debate and some of these other things that the geeks are really good at to get us out of the trap of falling for our own mental glitches. That's the story I'm trying to tell.
Well, we cannot wait for that book to hit. Maybe share with our listeners, like, do you have any daily habits that you've cultivated that serve your well-being, have become a habit, any non-negotiables?
Caffeine in the morning is super non-negotiable. My buddy Jonathan Rowan taught me a good one. He said, don't look at your screens for the first 15 minutes of the day. And I actually like that one a lot. So while I'm having my caffeine in the morning, I don't immediately start staring at a screen. And I really think that's a great idea. I also try to go for a walk early on every day. Not a huge one, just a short one, because it gets you out of the business of going from that horizontal posture to the hunched over at your desk posture, at least for a little while. Those are super low-level tips. That's all I got.
Perfect. So, you know, this is a podcast geared towards the MIT community. And, you know, are there any call to actions or thoughts you'd like to share with, you know, how the community could engage with your work or support, you know, or engage in their own efforts of what they're trying to accomplish in their life that might make a lasting impact for our larger community?
The main thing that I try to do myself, and it's hard, it's a constant battle, is to be part of the forces of evidence over the forces of ideology. And that is really hard to do because the ideologues are really good at what they're doing, and our brains are wired not for truth, but for tribalism. And again, that's just a mistake that it's easy to make about who we human beings are. We're not some, you know, truth-seeking missiles. We're deeply tribal creatures. And if your tribe around you believes X, Y, and Z, excellent chance you're going to believe that as well. So that it can feel lonely sometimes if you're part of the evidence over ideology crowd, but I think it's really important to do. You know, for example, we have to stop cooking our planet. It kind of a really important job for the 21st century is to accelerate the energy transition and avert the worst impacts of global warming. And to do that, we have to be really, really clear-eyed about where the opportunities are, where the bang for the buck is, and where the bang for the buck is not. And so, for example, that's turned me into kind of a nuclear power zealot, even though I have an visceral reaction to nuclear power because Three Mile Island happened when I was a kid at that same impressionable age. Chernobyl happened when I was in college. These are big, scary events that loom large, and you watch Godzilla, and you don't tell a happy story about nuclear accidents. The evidence is overwhelming that nuclear power is the only potent, scalable, non-intermittent, abundant, safe source of energy that we have right now. Now, renewables are great. Solar and wind are making amazing leaps forward in their productivity and declines in their cost. Yes, but there's another horse in that race that we have turned our back on for no good reasons. And I think our ick factor and our intuition and our ideologies are getting in the way there.
Great. So peel those back a little bit, it sounds like.
If please be like tribe evidence as opposed to tribe ideology.
Great.
It's one of the things we should be good at as part of the MIT community.
Totally. So, you know, MIT Talks wraps up all of their interviews with some signature questions. So there are just three questions here to wrap this up with you. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, Andrew, as it always is. So my first question is, what is one book you think everyone should read?
If I'm confining this to the MIT community, I would say The Visual Display of Quantitative Information by Edward Tufte, which is one of these books that changes your worldview because you can't look at a poorly prepared chart the same way anymore. It makes you fanatic about getting your point across with visualizations, and it stays with you forever.
Great. Okay, so second question here. Please use one word to describe your past, your present, and your future. So three words.
Okay.
One word for each. Past, present, and future.
Lucky, blessed, and uncertain.
Awesome. And the last question here, would you rather have a library full of books or a contact list full of names?
I'm going to give the wrong answer. My answer is library. Just curling up with a book is my happiest thing, but I know that what actually makes people happy is other people.
I've seen your library. It's quite extensive. Well, Andrew, this has been an amazing afternoon with you and sharing this interview with you and just giving our listeners a little more information about yourself and your work. I hope everyone has enjoyed it as much as I did.
It's been a blast. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for another inspiring episode of MIT Talks.
We would love to hear from you, our listeners. Engage with us at MIT Club of Boston's website or any of our social media channels.
Please send us your ideas for future podcast guests or reach out to further the conversation with your awesome co-hosts.
Thank you for listening to the MIT Talks.